Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the world's most dangerous infomercial. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this bi-weekly news, commentary, and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio in the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You could also catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett and exclusive bonus content by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Right now, we're live on Twitch, and you can follow the Numbers on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's Numbers with a Z. Begin each show with news stories you might have missed and should be on your radar. So now, without further ado, the news. First story comes from Oregon Live, titled Oregon's Minimum Wage is Going Up July 1st. Here's what it will be in various parts of the state by Mike Rogaway. So for those who don't know, in 2016, Oregon passed a minimum wage law that had a series of hikes. Hikes feels like a very strong word, but let me get into the article. According to Rogaway, the legislature portioned the state into three categories and set three different wage scales loosely based on the cost of living in each region. That means employers in rural counties and smaller cities don't have to pay their workers as much as those in the Portland metro area. So how does that break down? According to Rogaway, Portland area. Wages rise 5.4% in much of Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties from $14 to $14.75 an hour. Standard. Hourly wages rise 5.9% from $12.75 to $13.50 in most other counties in the western half of the state. That includes Deschutes, Benton, Lynn, Tillamook, Josephine, and Jackson counties, in some parts of the Portland area outside of the urban growth boundary. Finally, rural. Wages rise 4.2% in the rural counties that make up the rest of the state, from Curry County in the far southwest to Wallowa County in Oregon's far northeast. The hourly minimum is going from $12 to $12.50. So again, hikes is not exactly the right word, but minimum wage is rising slightly. And meanwhile, most people trying to work, you know, a full-time job on $20 an hour cannot really afford living, not really afford an actual like living wage life. So, see where the policy's at and where life is at. Hopefully, I say this, hopefully we can merge those closer and actually bring it up. So one, that $20 an hour is not just bare minimum, but something we're almost embarrassed to give people at some point. But until then, the work continues. Our next story comes from OPB by Conrad Wilson and Jonathan Levinson. It's titled, Man Accused of Shooting Five People, Killing One in Portland's Normandale Park Was Known to FBI. According to the authors, Benjamin Jeffrey Smith faces one murder charge, four counts of attempted murder, and four counts of assault for the shooting at Normandale Park in Northeast Portland. When the FBI contacted Smith in 2021, it had already received multiple tips over many years that he might be dangerous. People who met him online in furry communities, groups of online people who share an interest in anthropomorphic animals, told OPB that Smith seemed violent and said they had reported him to the FBI in the past. Months after being contacted by the FBI, Smith, 43, would stand accused of shooting five people with a handgun at a peaceful protest on February 19th in Normandale Park. One person died and another became paralyzed. Further down the article, they write, after receiving a credible tip, the FBI spent nearly a year investigating the man who would later kill 49 people and wound 53 others at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando in 2016. After sifting through the man's phone records, following him, interviewing him twice, and using informants to record over a dozen of his conversations, the agency concluded he did not pose a threat and closed the case. When the FBI receives a tip that someone may pose a credible threat to the community, the agency conducts a threat assessment. But without robust nationwide gun laws, federal law enforcement must fall back on a patchwork of local and state laws to address potential threats. And further on, they write, the tools available to law enforcement in Oregon include civil commitment and extreme risk protection orders, commonly called red flag laws. It's difficult to meet the standard for consigning someone who has not committed a crime to a hospital for a temporary mental health hold. Red flag laws allow immediate family members or law enforcement to petition a court to temporarily confiscate someone's firearms if they pose a threat to someone, to themselves or others. The state's judicial department, which oversees state courts, found no extreme risk protection orders and or any other restraining orders filed against Smith. So when we look at this and we look at the totality of other, you know, cases where the FBI is investigated, they mentioned obviously like the Pulse nightclub is one of the most extreme examples where they got tips for a while and then this man still ended up killing 49 people, 53 others. But what we look at is in one case, you know, just the gun amusement park that is America and the dangers that allows. Got this article and a lot of notions just coming from the FBI where they're asking, you know, we need more resources, even though the FBI, whether it be COINTELPRO, whether it be Trapman up to this day of black and brown people, where when they get more resources, just like law enforcement as a whole, it doesn't end up being used to stop, in particular, white supremacist terrorism, but really the biggest threats to us instead is used to somehow, it always finds a way to terrorizing black and brown people even more. So is that really, is giving them more resources really the answer? Also, how are we dealing with specifically these white supremacists, Christian fascists, this very, again, all this problem that seems to all stem from and have a common connection from that white supremacist thread that we're not really tackling. And I'm not just talking about from a law enforcement angle. I'm talking about from education. I'm talking about community resources, outreach, and all these preventative services. So again, we don't have to wait for law enforcement to get involved because apparently their only course for action is how can we use this to terrorize more black and brown people, or how can we, you know, use violence to, again, fix this problem, even though it seems to be growing more. So not a very uplifting story, but we'll keep an eye on how this case goes. And hopefully, how we do not use it to, so the FBI to do more of what the FBI has been doing. Next story comes from the Portland Mercury. It's titled, Charter Commission Sends Proposal to Overhaul City Government to November Ballot. It's by Alex Zielinski. And Zielinski writes, Portland voters will have the opportunity to seriously overhaul the city's government structure this November. Majority vote by the city's Charter Review Commission Tuesday evening advanced a package of three amendments to Portland's current charter, a document that serves as the city's constitution to the November 8th, 2022 ballot. So what are these new changes they're proposing? Zielinski writes, one, require ranked choice voting for city elections. Currently, Portlanders can only vote for one city candidate running in a city council race. And if no candidate receives more than 50% of the vote during a May primary election, the top two candidates advance to a runoff election in November. Under ranked choice voting, voters are able to rank council members for a particular office in order of preference. The elections office would determine a threshold of votes that must be met in order for the top candidate to win. If no candidates meet that threshold, the candidate with the last or with the least number of votes is eliminated, and voters who had ranked that candidate as their first choice would have their votes counted for their second choice. This process repeats until someone reaches the threshold. Also, this would do away with primary elections, which are usually held in May. Number two, expand city council to 12 members who represent geographic districts. Portland City Council is currently made up of five members, including the mayor, who are all elected in citywide elections. This expansion would boot the mayor off city council, create four geographic districts across the city, and elect three commissioners to represent each district. The mayor and city auditor would continue to be elected in citywide elections, but commissioners would be elected only by those who live in their district. An independent districting commission would be appointed to draw initial districts to ensure they are equitably divided. 3, limit city council to setting policy while the mayor and city administrator oversee bureaus. Portland commissioners currently serve as both bureau and administrators and policymakers, as both bureau administrators and policymakers. A responsibility that can often lead to conflicts of interest and general mismanagement. This amendment would remove bureau leadership from commissioners' portfolios, allowing them to focus solely on crafting legislation. The mayor, who would no longer vote as a member of city council under this charter update, would be tasked with overseeing administration of the city bureaus with the assistance of a new city employee, a city administrator confirmed by city council. The new city administrator would be responsible for supervising, hiring, and firing most bureau directors. And Zielinski further writes, Portland is the sole outlier among cities with similar populations when it comes to its current commission form of government. Most U.S. cities scrapped this form of government in the 1960s when federal courts ruled that at-large voting led to systemic underrepresentation of racial minorities. So this is one of those stories that is both fascinating in the potential for genuine systemic change that it causes. It's also, you know, full of the bureaucratic minutiae that often makes people roll their eyes and not pay attention. All that said, these changes will be on the November 8th ballot. And if you are city of Portland, I would highly recommend that you pay close attention because, again, as Zielinski notes, Portland's one of the only cities left that, at least of its size, that uses this form of government, and systemic and underrepresentation, specifically of Black and Brown people, is a problem we continue to deal with. Now you have few mechanisms for actually fixing that truly structural way. So again, we'll be on the November 8th ballot. Pay attention. Final story also comes from the Portland Mercury. It's titled "The Curriculum Culture Wars Come to Portland Area Schools," and it's by Isabella Garcia. So Garcia writes, Oregon is one of the few states where bills opposing LGBTQ rights or CRT have not been introduced, but the state isn't immune to the culture war. School Board Newburgh, a city about an hour's drive southwest of Portland, made national headlines last year when it banned Black Lives Matter signs, LGBTQ pride flags, and other, quote, political, quasi-political, or controversial, unquote, symbols from the classroom. Further, she writes, opposition to LGBTQ inclusivity in schools has been brewing in Oregon for years. In 2017, a parent group sued the state, Dallas School District, and the federal government for allowing transgender students to use the restroom and locker room that matched with their gender identity, claiming that it violated cisgender students' civil rights. The case is still ongoing as the group has unsuccessfully tried to elevate it to U.S. Supreme Court. Further, Zielinski writes, schools can play a major role in LGBTQ students' mental health. According to the Trevor Project, LGBTQ youth who have at least one LGBTQ-affirming space are 35% less likely to report a suicide attempt in the past year compared to those without supportive spaces. In other words, schools creating inclusive and affirming environments can be the difference between life and death for some students. Now, this article also goes through a number of case studies, one with the Newburgh School District, another with Westland Wilsonville, and most recently in Portland, specifically at Abernathy School and with their principal, Christy Peterson. Has decided not to bring back a couple of teachers based on their outward support of Black Lives Matter, of LGBTQ students, it's a variety of progressive issues. And Garcia writes, this isn't Peterson's first foray into limiting educational material. Prior to joining Abernathy in 2019, Peterson was the principal at an elementary school in eastern Oregon town of Hermiston. In 2018, Peterson and all other Hermiston elementary school principals withdrew their schools from the Oregon Ballot of the Books, a statewide reading competition due to the reading list of including a book about a transgender child. According to Anita Guaido, the parent of an Abernathy student, Peterson's past has raised concerns among parents who want Abernathy to be a safe, inclusive space for transgender students. This alarm culminated in a virtual meeting in March of more than 30 parents where attendees discussed concerns with Peterson's leadership. including a lack of clarity of her stance on LGBTQ rights, her questioning of Shulton's classroom posters, and Peterson's alleged treatment of LaToya Lovely, the only Black educator at Abernathy who resigned the following month due to alleged racial discrimination. According to Lovely, Peterson required her to perform additional tasks not required of her white peers, like signing in and out of school, and restricted Lovely from using teaching spaces that were available to all other teachers. Following her resignation, Lovely filed a complaint with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, stating that PPS's Human Resources Department did not intervene despite Lovely documenting her experiences with Peterson for months prior to resigning. So when you combine this with the current debate at Tubman over teacher Brian Chu, and his opposition or his lessons on the I-5 freeway and gentrification as a whole, what you're seeing is two things kind of come together. On one hand, Portland and Oregon as a whole has not been nearly as influenced by, anti-LGBTQ, anti-CRT, anti-trans legislation as states like, say, Florida. However, there are groups going around the state and coming to school board meetings, whether it be in Clackamas or Newburgh, and even Portland, often people who are not from these areas, who are not parents in these communities, or not members, who are pushing very hard and trying to pressure people into, rolling back any type of progressive curriculum, any type of, curriculum that affirms non-white Christian people. And can't take for granted Oregon's reputation as this like liberal bastion, because reality is it's actually just look at the map, it's actually a very red state. Just you have populations that are big pockets of population that make it vote blue in places like Portland and obviously spread out throughout the state. But the threat is real right now, and they're going directly for kids. Like they may frame it as we're trying to protect the kids, but they're terrorizing and attacking children, and they're doing it in plain sight. So gotta respond. And that's the news. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer. But will I defend the prequels? Yes.
If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett.
Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. We're recording this on NBA draft day. Whoop, whoop. Yes, sir. And for those who don't know, Blazers made a move last night, basically trading a future first round pick for Jeremy Grant, who was actually born in Portland. And fun fact, actually went to preschool with his brother back at Touchstone.
You went to preschool with his brother?
Yeah. So I don't know if it's older or younger, but Back at the time, Harvey Grant was, Horace Grant's brother, was playing with the Blazers. So at, the preschool I was at, like, his son was in there very briefly. And then, not to get into stories, but basically they pushed him out. And you saw, wow, even, I guess, being a Blazers kid does not get you much in this white system.
Yes.
There's a lot behind that, but we're gonna stick to happy things today.
Yes. Yes. Yes,
so,
yes.
You know, it's a good time. The Blazers have a new GM, Joe Cronin.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah, we just made this move, and if you go on Blazer Twitter, you see everyone's talking about bring me back to the Cron Zone tonight. So, you know, good times. Yeah, Ado, do you spend much time on Blazer Twitter out of curiosity?
I just spend a lot of time on general NBA Twitter, but what I'm curious, because Blazer Twitter is like, I've heard stories. I've heard stories of how wild it can get there. So I'm curious what you're seeing currently on Blazer Twitter.
Yeah, it's it's all the things one both likes and hates about Twitter at times.
Makes sense.
But one thing I can't help but notice is that I feel like a lot of Blazer fans are aspiring to be like Knicks fans.
Oh, absolutely.
And I have a theory why. Partially because just sports media is dominated by disgruntled Knicks fans.
True.
So, true. You know, maybe chief among them, Stephen A. Smith, who also is arguably the loudest among them.
Yeah.
Literally and figuratively.
Uh-huh.
And you see disgruntled, screaming Knicks fans on TV all day. You know, there's something, I guess, the appeal to it. Like, you also see someone like, you know, Jesus and Miro, for example,
mm-hmm.
where there's that aspiration, like, at the beginning of the year, without fail, Knicks fans, for some reason, they think they're going to win it all or go to the playoffs.
Every year.
Do anything, you know, important. And within, like, about a month, maybe. I mean, do you remember this past season? Like, that first month, it was everyone's yes. like, bing bong, bing yep. bong.
That is so funny to me, because that is actually from a YouTube channel that I follow, Side Talk NYC. It's like a series where they just kind of go around the streets of New York and talk to random people. And there was a hot second there where, like, there was many episodes where they thought that the Knicks were going to do it all. And no, they did not.
Oh, man. It ended. It ended poorly and so quickly. So
poorly. I'm curious because, and obviously I want to go back to the Blazers, but with the Knicks, how do they continue to get, like, no good draft picks? Or, like, they tend to draft very non-notable players.
You know, I'm glad you asked this. And first off, shout out to, you know, RJ Barrett is balling.
I'll give him
credit there. But I feel like this is a great segue into talking about how we vastly overvalue billionaires. And I feel like James Dolan is the owner of the Knicks, for those who don't know, is like, it's a great metaphor for that, because yeah, just poor management on a team level.
Yeah.
Dealing with, he threw out, you know, Knicks legend and all back alley team Hall of Famer Charles Oakley,
yeah,
and like banned him from Madison Square Garden. Like, just he's a terrible, terrible example of, yeah.
Why do we value?
Like, he spends more time allegedly with his, you know, like bar band than making good basketball moves. Just awful.
Deeply disappointing.
Yeah. So, you know, again, maybe we give too much credence to billionaires, and just a thought. But anyways, back to the Blazers.
Theme of the show.
So, when I talk about Blazers fans being Knicks fans, like, on one hand, like, especially this year, because the Blazers were obviously tanking, and
yep.
a lot of people didn't seem to catch on to that, even though, I don't know, it's like, oh, Josh Hart, you know, has a hangnail. We're going to, you know, bench him for the rest of the season. Like, everyone's like, no, what are the Blazers going to do? Or, you know, Dame had, yeah, he had an ab injury, but he also probably could have played like the last 2 months.
Yeah.
He didn't. There's a thing they do there.
The tank was very clear.
I will say, with like Blazer fans specifically, again, trying to be Knicks fans is
the classic.
There are, the bad ways, such as during the tank and all this despair, and every time a trade happens, like when we trade away CJ. And I just want to be clear to everyone watching, like, I love CJ McCollum.
CJ love.
Between his game and the fact that he was like super passionate about journalism and just in like some of like the youth work I do, like we haven't personally crossed paths, but like he's done interviews with for the students I work with at Madison at the time, now McDaniels, did interviews with this black student journalism program I worked with U of O. And then also did some stuff with the Boys and Girls Club where he has, you know, a room, you know, the CJ McCollum reading room or whatever it's named after. Very like, impressive. So it's like, I could not escape the influence of CJ. And it's kind of cool. He's also, you know, now owns one of the wineries out here. But I digress. Is, you know, everyone's despair. It's like, oh my goodness, we traded away CJ for nothing. And it's like, okay, no, one, Josh Hart can ball.
Is not nothing.
Two, we got a trade exception that we turned into Jeremy Grant, which means we traded CJ for Josh Hart and Jeremy Grant. I think the value is decent there.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, Portland fans being like Knicks fans were despairing at the time, not looking, you know, with the foresight. But on the flip side, the thing I love about Portland fans also trying to aspire to be Knicks fans is that after every like playoff series, you know, you see like when the Nets lose, immediately you see Photoshop, you know, these Photoshop pics of Kevin Durant and Blazers jerseys. When the Sixers lost, sorry, Ambush, Photoshop jerseys of Embiid in Blazer jerseys. Like, manifestation season is in full effect. None of it is realistic. Who's coming to Portland? I don't know. I've heard rumors that, you know, Kevin Durant, all he loves to do is play basketball, be on Twitter, and smoke weed. And I'm like, I know a place.
Yep.
I know a place that is not run like a dumpster fire like the Nets, where you could do that. You could have defense around you. You could have the best clutch player in the league.
Yes.
Just, but again, if I have to be realistic, I suppose we'll tamp it down.
Yeah.
That said, in this new era, the Crone Zone, as they're apparently calling it, I have notes on that, but we'll digress. I say, like, it is great. You know, I would love for the Blazers to be competitive again. But, you know, having, again, the post, I think my favorite one was just seeing people Photoshop. Or no, not the Photoshop. It's the messaging behind it. You know, Giannis needs to do what's best for him and his family and come to Portland. Just like, yes. Let's keep that energy.
Yes, please.
KD needs to do what's best for him. Embiid needs to do what's best for him. You know what, Luka? I know you just got to the Western Conference Finals and, you know, Dallas is going to build a monument to you. But come to Portland. Do what's best for you and your family.
I'm curious, if you could dream up the ultimate Blazer trade, like, or we sign someone from free agency, who would you like to join the team?
See, I got this dream. Again, I just said I was going to reel it back in. But nah.
Let's go crazy.
Like, we got the seventh pick.
Yes.
We've got a huge asset in Ant Simons, who I think he could be an East All-Star.
I agree.
And I know an East team right now that is, let's say they're having struggles with their current point guard. A certain Kyrie Irving.
Oof.
Maybe they could just decide to, you know, rebuild and try to do something organically, because they did this whole thing where they got KD, James Harden, and Kyrie Irving together, and then it blew up spectacularly. Why not just try again? Like, I don't know, Ant. Sorry, Ant, if I ever run into you.
We love you, but
if you ever see this segment.
Yes.
But, you know, Ant, seventh pick, other assets.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I've talked with people about this and be like, Bruce, that's not realistic. But have you watched Brooklyn? like not the team play basketball, like their front office. Have you watched how they operated?
They operate strange.
That's a very nice way of saying poorly.
Yes.
Like, I'm just saying anything is possible. And again, KD needs to do what's best for him and his family.
Yep.
Fix the legacy. You know, we made a mistake. We did. We drafted Odin over you. We're sorry. But we can make everything right. We can fix your legacy because everyone keeps saying those Warriors championships aren't real.
Yeah.
Again, if this ever happens and KD and I come across paths, I'm sorry. I apologize in advance. If you come to Portland, I will recant everything.
Yes.
But I'm just saying, do what's best for you.
Your family.
What's right for you. Exactly.
Take
your family.
The fam. We know you like weed. We have a plentiful amount of that.
You know, you're into the business side. There's things around here. Come do stuff with Intel. Come kick it with Will I Am and his like quarterly meetings with Intel staff. Make the money. There are opportunities out here, and it's quiet. The yes. New York media is terrible.
Uh-huh.
The Portland media is terrible, but it's not as big.
Exactly.
Do what's best for you and your family, KD.
For you and the fam, KD.
And meanwhile, the draft is tonight, and more than likely we'll just pick someone at 7th and
yeah.
Nothing will happen. But, KD,
we don't
if
know.
You're listening.
If Portland, you're listening, come to Portland, please.
Do what's best for you and your family. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for my newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. And welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. I've got a special guest in studio. First time doing an in-studio interview. So, you know, cue up in post, cue up all the audience clapping and everything. But I got Lakiana Drury, the executive director and founder of Word is Bomb PDX. How are you doing today?
I'm great. We had a lovely pre-show discussion about Star Wars. We're getting ready for a summer internship program. So everything is firing over here.
Yeah, that's awesome. And again, thank you again for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So for the sake of dramatic tension, I suppose, we'll just start. We're going to start the interview off. I hover around a lot of like abolitionist circles who are going to be wondering, you know, why are you talking with, you know, Lakiana when they work with the police in this way? And I just read a quote off of the site where you say, you know, Word is Bomb is not an organization that tries to get young black men to like police officers or change their minds on how they feel about law enforcement. We do not censor the stories our young men tell. We empower young black men to speak their truths. But to that point, can you just one talk about, because the organization has since kind of like evolved into a bigger like leadership development program.
Yeah.
But can you talk about one, what your police engagement, I guess, like looks like?
Yeah.
And two, you know, what is the biggest, I guess, misconception about that?
I love this question. I'm glad that you started this off. And I had a feeling that maybe that's what we would talk about. So I'm excited about that because it's a really challenging question. And I can't sit here and say that I have all the answers or I even know 100% where it's all going to go. And I think if anybody who creates a program or a technology or whatever it is, like they're lying if they say they know exactly how it's going to go and exactly what they're doing with it. There's always some belief you have to have in it. And I would say that it's kind of where it starts with me. I'm an optimist. I generally believe in the good in people and in the good in society. I'm always a glass half full type of person. And I think the biggest misnomer around Word is Bond and the policing aspect of it is like that's the central component of it. In a city like Portland, it's really hard because policing is such a huge issue. Really in the last few years, Which is one thing I'm really proud about Word is Bond, is we didn't start in response to George Floyd. This is not a George Floyd post murder movement. This is prior to that. And I always find myself having to clarify or explain the law enforcement component of it. And there's a lot of different camps, you know, like we're in the city of bridges, and that's where I feel like I'm a bridge builder, and I'm somebody who, because I believe in the goodness of society, like I'm in a unique position where I can try and like help bridge and bring those groups together. So what we're attempting to do is to create dialogue. And that's where that quote comes from. It's like the dialogue isn't like geared towards some specific like endpoint. Like we want all of our youth to believe this about policing, or we want police to believe all this about young Black men. Like it's a space for dialogue, and then they take with it from it what they will. My personal view is that policing will be here. It's not gonna go away. In some form or fashion, it'll be here. And so it's like, okay, well, knowing that, how do we create space where those most impacted by it can share their truths? And to your point about Word is Bond expanding from that, it's exactly true. Like that was one of the core pieces when we started, and then we've kind of added on since then. I will say that I think a lot of people use the policing aspect to not listen to the rest of what we do. And I'm aware of that, you know? And I know people that just like, we look at our program, they're just like, I'm just gonna use this to ignore all the other stuff that we do. And we do so much else outside of that. And I think that that's just a particular part of our program. And I'm still trying to figure it out. And why I say it's so challenging is that, like, I think a lot of people, it's funny, one of our youth one time asked me, he said, Mr. Drury, do you like the police or not? And it was really funny because he had been through our program. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure out what is my personal view on policing? And I don't have a view on policing as much as I have a view on our country. And our country is run and founded on white supremacy. And if you can have that foundational understanding, then my view on policing is very clear. It's seen through that lens, and it's not, and white supremacy is not unique to just policing. It is in all aspects of our society. So I don't look at the police and say, in their uniqueness of what they are capable of doing, which is taking life, right? They're one of the only groups in our society that has that ability and judgment in their job to do that. But I don't look at policing as any more ingrained with institutional racism or white supremacy than any other group. So, and with that foundation, I feel very confident that when I approach policing work, that I'm able to do it from a lens that is empowering. And rightfully so, when you are going to sit down with young Black men and policing, there is a natural question of, how are you doing this? What is your lens that you're looking for? And what is your ultimate goal? And so I welcome all those questions, and those questions should be asked. And my only piece to that is that when people are genuinely willing to listen, I'm ready to have that conversation. But sometimes I feel that they already have their mind made up. And so it's if you want to listen and you want to know the story of Word is Bond, it's a beautiful story. If you want to just focus on the policing aspect of it and say, well, I hate the police, so I don't care about this program. And it's the only voices I really care about are our young men's voices. They're the ones in this program. Everybody outside of it can have their opinion, but you're not going through this program, and you're also not the target of it. Our goal with Word is Bond is to empower young Black men, point blank, period. And so giving them exposure to many different aspects and places to use their voice is our goal. And so in returning to the original point, my goal, I don't have a set way that I'm trying to guide our youth when they have these conversations with law enforcement. And they come from a variety of backgrounds. Some have had very adverse experiences with police. Some have had none. And then you got a bunch of adults around the outside trying to input their view of it, like, oh, y'all should hate the police, or we should abolish it, or and some support it and some like to see it. So it's a variety, and I have to balance all those voices. And when I see a murder like George Floyd, yeah, I'm going to sit home for like the next 5 days. Like, what am I doing with this program? Am I leading it in the right direction? And then you see killing after killing and various other racial incidents. Does that keep me up at night? Do I ever sit there and think like, dang, is this the right thing to do? Absolutely. And that goes back to my original point of when you create something, you never 100% know where it's going or how it's going to be. But I do believe that I can impact things. And I've seen officers come through our program and say, I learned something today. And I've seen young men come through our program and say, I learned something today. And if that can happen, then that's at least worth trying. And this is just my version of how I think society can change. It doesn't stop anybody else from working on their aspects of it. And so what we do in Word is Bond is a particular lane, but it's not everything. And I think that's another misnomer people have, is they think that somehow that I'm suggesting, or that Word is Bond is suggesting, that by having young Black men in law enforcement sit down, that that will alleviate institutional racism or police brutality. Conversation needs to happen. Policy change needs to happen. Culture change needs to happen. Institutions need to be changed. All of that. And we are just one lane of many.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's a few things there that really resonated with me. I think that idea, we talk about using, you know, a police engagement as basically a way to like shut off the rest of the conversation or not listen to anything else. I really, see that a lot in terms of not just that, but I feel like in some way, like just because we have so much access to information, and especially today we're on like so much like social media stuff where it's just like everything is not just, we don't just have access, we're competing for attention. So we're like, people are overwhelmed, and anything that gives you the opportunity or the chance to be like, okay, I don't have to think about that anymore. Like, mm-hmm. We jump at that like at a fundamental way. But specifically with this, I think, you know, we live in like an ecosystem of different tactics, and this isn't like a new idea. This has always been the case, especially when it comes to Black liberation. And I know I've had, like, my mom worked as a principal and administrator in Portland Public Schools for decades, and before that, New Jersey. You know, I've done stuff with, as far as like anti-racism organizing stuff, mm-hmm. in LO, and I'll say as far as like a particular connection there, because we've had some officers in LO who've, you know, worked with the Word is Bond program or gone, mm-hmm. to like some of the sessions. And I'll be honest with you, like when we'd have conversations about like policy with them, and specifically around like profiling, and they'd be like, well, I've been through, you know, I went to Word is Bond and it was great. And it gives me part of that, like, are you just using them as like a prop? But I say that because with a group I'm a part of, Respond to Racism LO, I've seen people do a similar thing where they're like, well, I go to the Respond to Racism meetings, so everything's fine, right? And it's like, hold on. Because right. It's like, because that's not even like, I don't put that on you or the program. I don't put that on us. And it's not necessarily even on these people saying that, because it's just, you know, what we say in passing in conversation. But you know the feeling you get when you hear that, yeah, where you're like, 100%. Are you really, I hope you're getting, I hope you're taking more than that from it, right? But also understand that, you know, there's a lot of, there's gray areas in this. Like, I'm not a big police fan personally, but I also know that, you know, again, just through having, you know, a mom who worked in education, you know, through my other experiences, the reality is like a lot of intel and a lot of like information I have as far as like how things work systemically inside has come directly from talking with like Black officers, just, you know, informally. Mm-hmm. And it's not just like, it's not just a, I'm on this side, you're on this side. It's like, again, we all live in like this like ecosystem.
Right.
And where there's a lot of different tactics, there's a lot of different engagement, and, you know, what you said about like being an optimist and believing in people, you know, I feel that. And like, even if, you know, your tactics are different than mine, we're both like, we both care about young Black men in particular, in our community, and we're trying to make it work. So that's why I was really glad you, you know, we're open to this conversation.
Absolutely.
And really welcoming that first question, especially. But to that point about how Word is Bond has evolved, can you just talk about, you know, sort of the different aspects of the program? I know you do like done trips. It's big on leadership development. You've got working on a summer internship program right now.
Yeah.
So you just talk a little bit, you know, give people a little bit of an overview of that.
Yeah. I mean, like, so, right. Like if when people want to talk about Word is Bond and what it does, this, that, or the third, we're employing 30 young men this summer. Talk about that, right? $50,000 our young men will make collectively. That's huge. In a city that doesn't offer many opportunities for young Black men, youth in general, youth of color, that's a huge opportunity. And that's why that's like one of my the biggest things about our program is the economic impact that it's able to have. And then the exposure, like our goal is to help expose our young men to as many possibilities and as possible versions of themselves that they can be. So our summer internship program is called Rising Leaders. It's 7 weeks long, it's paid, and it's a 3-year rite of passage program. We've built out 2 of the years so far. So the first year is a cohort-based model where they meet 4 days a week. It's business casual dress, so they're learning how to be in professional environments, learning what it feels like to be in a suit, which is for Black men a very powerful feeling if you're ever in a room with other Black men in suits, and especially to be as young as they are, 16 to about 19 years old. They learn public speaking, career exploration. We have the public safety piece, which not only includes dialogues with officers, which just to go back on that one more time, there's 5 workshops. The officers come out of uniform, no weapons, and we start with interpersonal storytelling. So we're not talking about race. We're not talking about George Floyd, like police, nothing. It's like the first meeting is just like, who are you? And like sharing those stories, and it's all interactive workshops. So it's never like we're just sitting down like in 2 chairs and like, tell me about yourself. But it's like guided workshops led by myself. And then through the subsequent weeks, they get deeper and deeper into the conversations till about week 4, where we can like, we've built enough of a foundation where we can have some of those larger conversations. So that's the law enforcement aspect, which takes up about, I would say about like 15 to 18% of the summertime program. So what are we doing for the rest of those days? They each are work on a storyteller project, which features a mantra that they create, goals for their future, a vision statement. They get professional photos once they get their suits that we tailor for them. So they get to see themselves in really powerful ways, and having a professional headshot for yourself and a picture that you designed where it was taken and the colors of your suit, and then learning to tell your personal story. And I think that's what gets swept under the rug so much sometimes, is like, that's what Word is Bond is at its core. It's about storytelling. And what is your story? And for young Black men, our stories are so often told for us or told by other entities, and oftentimes in negative ways and portrayals. And so it's helping our young men discover, what is my story and what path and what can I be in this, in a world that has so often shown me very few possibilities, either incarceration or entertainment of some sorts, whether it's athletics or music. And outside of that, there's not much expected of us. So we want to complement, or not even complement, but offer what is not offered in school about your cultural identity. Get them exposed to different Black leaders in the community. Get them to learn about their history. So they do tours around the neighborhood, learning about Portland's Black history, learning about Vanport, learning about the Black Panther Party. We have a Black Women's Luncheon, and so that's an opportunity to hear from Black women. What are their experiences, and how, as a young Black man, do I interact with women? We talk about mental health. We do outdoor leadership. Portland, Oregon is the center for outdoors, right? But there's such white spaces. So we take our young men camping, many of whom have never been on a trail, right? And so exposing them to different ideas and aspects of life so that they can see what they can be. And then that's the 7-week first year program. Second year, they're offsite in different internships. So this summer we'll have 9 different internships. We have one at Hood to Coast, one at Titan Freight, one at Sockeye Marketing and Development, district attorney's office. One will be with Senator Ron Wyden. So they get to learn and see all different career fields that they could possibly be in. We'll have one here at the numbers, which is awesome. In the school year, we just started a 7-day leadership trip to Washington, D.C. My goal is to get them outside of this city. In a city as white as Portland, Oregon, you don't have much perspective. I remember I had a student one time and he said, Mr. Drury, like, I have friends that have never left our block, never left our community, and I don't want that to end up happening to me. And I know from my own experience growing up, we didn't have extra money to be going to Disney World or taking a trip, let alone out of the country. So our 7-day leadership program is completely paid for the young men. The only thing that they have to do is raise $400, which works on their other leadership skills of public speaking and things of that nature. And we took 11 of them this past March. It was an amazing experience for them to see East Coast cities, to go talk to officers who work in an agency that's almost never had a white police chief, to be in a city where 40% of the population is black, and it's not strange to see large groups of black people. So we got to go to Philly as well. We got to go to Baltimore, and even having their suits everywhere they went, people's heads were turning. Where are y'all from? And I told the guys, I'm like, I guarantee you, they're never going to think you're from Portland, Oregon. They thought they were in law school. They thought we were from Atlanta, Georgia. And they were kind of dreading wearing their suits everywhere they went, especially the black people. Oh my gosh. You're just like, wow. Like, it's so great to see. And by the end of it, they get it. They're like, I understand why we're in these suits, why I'm here, why I'm a part of this. And you see their minds see the bigger picture of just everything that we're doing. And a lot of them come into our program and they want to be paid. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for a summer job. And it's like, I'm not faulting them. You coming from a lot of different communities. Who doesn't want to be paid? What adult doesn't want to be paid? But when they get into the program and they see all the other things that we do, you know, it's so much more than that. I'm able to put money in your pocket, but I'm also able to put an idea in your mind. And that idea that I want to stick in every young black man's mind is that you can be whatever you want. Everything is possible. And we're not shown that. We're not shown that in classrooms. We're not shown that in society. When we walk past people, when we show up at a public place like a mall or a park, we're often shunned or not wanted in those places. And so I'm trying to help our young men see the infinite possibilities of what they can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Akyon, thank you again for coming on the Bruce Poinsett Show. We're going to have you come in the studio again for some pure Star Wars slander.
Yes, sir.
As we did. We all love Star Wars here, but DJ Ambush here has a weird affinity for The Last Skywalker that we gotta take down. But anyways,
yeah.
Thank you again for talking about Word is Bond.
Appreciate it.
All the best.
Thank you.
You know, going forward. And yeah, we're gonna keep an eye on everything you're doing.
Likewise, appreciate it.
And this has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.